This is Scott Becker. I'm a partner at McGuire Woods, the publisher of Becker's Healthcare, and the publisher and founder of C-Suite Reports. Thrilled today to be joined by Jeff Cockrell. Jeff is the chair of the McGuire Woods Private Equity Group. He also serves on the firm's board of partners. He is a true leader in the private equity area. For today's call, I'm going to ask him about 8 to 10 questions about the business of private equity and really work with him to try and give our audience a great education on the business of private equity. Jeff, do you want to take one moment and introduce yourself, and then we'll start asking you questions?
Sure. Thanks a lot, Scott. As Scott indicated, I'm the head of the McGuire Woods Private Equity Group. McGuire Woods has got about 1,100 lawyers across the country and some in Europe. My group in the private equity universe has 60 or 70 attorneys that work in the private equity group, and we represent private equity funds across a whole host of sectors, different sizes, different investment strategies, but that's what I do in my day job.
Thank you very much. And Jeff, very simply, how does private equity make money? How do private equity funds make money, and what's the typical sort of makeup for how they do that?
Sure. There's kind of two levels. One is the fund. So a private equity fund consists of limited partners that are putting in capital, which are tend to be kind of institutional investors. So pension funds, universities, endowments, things like that, that have capital to invest, and then fund managers. As between the investors, the limited partners in the fund, and the fund managers, the general economics for the fund managers is that they are going to make round about 2% per year on the aggregate kind of capital commitments to the fund as a fee. And then they're going to make 20% of the profits if the fund is successful kind of on the back end. So that 2 and 20 model, there's some variation in it, but that the general structure between the fund managers and the investors is that the fund manager is going to get that 2% management fee and also get 20% of the profits over the life of the fund.
And just for our audience's information, can you name some of the biggest PE funds and just give us a moment on that?
Sure. The private equity universe kind of covers a broad array. Some of the largest ones in the country are somewhat recognizable names that you would see in the newspaper, on the news: Blackstone, TPG, Carlyle, KKR, and they may have $5 to $10 billion of capital commitments, making investments in buying very large companies. But that's just kind of one end of the ecosphere. The private equity universe goes all the way down to kind of the baseline investments where, say, a mom and pop business, family owned, has been existing for decades. And there are private equity funds that are kind of the first institutional investors in those companies. And they will be buying companies all the way down to kind of the smallest size that you could put in a bigger kind of operating platform on. So $2, $3, $5 million of net income. But that ranges from that end all the way up to the massive $10 billion funds. There's an entire array of different private equity fund sizes.
And over the last several years, private equity has become more often the buyer in all kinds of deals, as opposed to strategic buyers, meaning a company that's already in the business. Can you give us a flavor for deal multiples and how deals are priced and whether going in the right or wrong direction?
Multiples are usually framed as a multiple of EBITDA, which is kind of a modified version of kind of the net income of the company on an annual basis. And the multiples kind of depend on what the growth trajectory of the business is. So if it's a manufacturing company that has kind of slow, steady growth, the multiples, even at kind of bigger size scale, they may trade on 6, 7, 8 times kind of the trailing 12 months EBITDA, whereas more explosive growth type companies, IT companies, healthcare provider services companies, where if you add capital to those businesses so they can do kind of de novo expansion or do growth through acquisition, if you do one of those strategies that the growth of the company can be much more explosive, then those multiples can be much higher. In healthcare, where I spend most of my time, if you get a company of much scale, it may be trading at 10, 12, 14 times EBITDA or more, but that's a function of kind of A, the availability of capital, sort of kind of supply demand, of if there's money on the buy side to be bidding these companies up, and then also what the kind of projected growth trajectory of that target is, and the more kind of explosive growth potential is there, then the higher multiple those businesses trade at.
And Jeff, it seems like over the last several years, private equity, if not having taken over the world, is far more competitive as a buyer and often the highest bidder on deals. Why is that? Why has that sort of evolved like that?
There's a number of factors. One of them is the private equity community's kind of access to capital. Private equity 20 years ago was kind of a little bit more on the fringes of investing, but over time, private equity has become an asset class. So everyone who has money in, say, a pension or an endowment, they're allocating their capital to different kind of investment types. And private equity now is one of those types. And so they're going to get an allocation of 3%, 4%, 5% of all of the money that they have. So that has kind of pushed that has pushed dollars into private equity. Plus, the availability of leverage has been very, very high, both in traditional lenders like banks, and then also kind of a version of private equity that is really just a lender, not a buyer. So all of this money flooding into the asset class of private equity has made that group of potential buyers flush with capital to invest. And all of that makes for a frothy environment for selling companies, which not surprisingly pushes the prices up, as well as kind of folks' expectations as it relates to the economy. The economy's been strong. People have been bullish in general. So those factors, coupled with private equity funds being flush with both their own capital and the availability of debt to kind of increase their returns, has made them very competitive buyers.
And Jeff, are there certain industries that private equity is more focused on today than others? And how do you see that?
Private equity funds are very thematic, meaning they're not generally just kind of scouring the entire universe for companies to buy. They build kind of themes around industries that the fund managers know and have experience with. But the types of industries where private equity funds have been getting the most interest are where there are companies that have barriers to growth that private equity funds are well situated to solve. So if you think of like a medical practice that gets to a certain size, or a family-owned business in another sector, if the barriers to growth are capital or certain kinds of expertise, skill sets of managing a bigger company, if you think of like if the growth strategy is to buy other companies, then you need two things. You need capital to do that, and you need kind of the skill set of acquiring other companies, which is not a natural skill set to people who built a business up to a certain size. Private equity is very good at both of those things. They've got lots of capital at their fingers to execute on an acquisition-based growth strategy. So you buy one company, and then you're going to buy 10 or 15 smaller ones. That takes a lot of capital, and private equity funds are well situated for that. It also takes a different skill set of being skilled at acquiring businesses or identifying and executing on an acquisition, or skilled in operating a bigger company, where private equity funds are both skilled in doing acquisitions. They're also good at building an infrastructure around a bigger company. So when there are industries and sectors where those barriers to growth are things that private equity is built to solve, those tend to be areas where private equity funds have a lot of interest. Like I said, I do mostly healthcare type transactions, and healthcare, especially in kind of provider services, doctor practices, dental practices, things like that. The way to grow a lot of them is through a combination of those two factors. So a private equity fund will buy a practice, and then they'll be looking to buy 15 more. They're built to do that. They're also designed to build out the infrastructure that a bigger organization needs. And that tends to be the types of industries that they focus on, where they're well suited to kind of solve the barriers to growth.
And here's another question for you, Jeff. Do PE funds always invest for long term, meaning 5 to 7 years, or is there a shorter term? Just talk for a moment about the typical hold period of a private equity investor in a transaction or company.
Sure. So the starting point to think about kind of the investment horizon is to start with thinking about the life cycle of the fund itself. They're generally built with a 10-year kind of basic life cycle. So the way they are set up is they go out to investors and say, hey, I want you to commit capital to making these acquisitions. And so they'll get $200 million, $500 million, $1 billion, however much they're going to have of capital commitments. And then the first 5 years of the fund, roundabout, they are making investments, acquiring businesses. And the second half, they are kind of maturing and then selling those businesses. So they're only going to be investing their entire commitments in the first 1, 2, 3, maybe 4 years. And then they are needing to kind of be out of those companies by the end of the fund life. So a typical private equity fund is going to have a 3 to 5 year hold period for an individual investment, which means that they're going to be investing a lot of capital in each of these platforms, making a lot of acquisitions, doing a lot of things to improve and grow those companies, because the life cycle of the fund necessitates them not holding those things forever. There are obviously different business models out there that don't look like that. Some large family offices or business development companies are designed to hold things kind of forever, but that's not how private equity funds are built.
Thank you. You had mentioned earlier the leveraged finance environment and leverage to transactions. Can you take a moment and explain what that means and how that interplays with private equity?
So let's take a $100 million company a private equity fund wants to acquire. They may be only putting 30 or 40 million of their own capital in, and will be borrowing the balance of that 100 from either commercial lenders or these kind of semi-funds that are lenders themselves. A private equity fund that's buying a $100 million company that's only putting 30 million of its own in, that additional leverage, the rate of return on the interest on that, the debt component is going to be relatively modest, which enables them, if they can then sell it for, let's say, $150 million, they put in 30 of their own and are going to have 50 of that gain. So you can see how leveraging those acquisitions can really dial up their gain potential. Obviously, like everything else in the investing and universe, leverage has risk, and it can go sideways as well. And if things go sideways, those lenders are going to get paid before the private equity fund does.
And so in an environment where leverage is readily available, that will have what impact? Will that help push prices up for deals that private equity is investing in?
It the availability of capital puts more money in buyers' pockets to make investments, and it always has the effect of pushing the prices and multiples up. For example, there's generally thought that it would only take a percentage or two increase in interest rates to kind of lower those purchase multiples by, say, a full turn, because the availability and pricing of leverage is very, very closely tied to how much money buyers are willing to pay for companies.
And Jeff, you mentioned earlier some of the largest PE funds. Do you have a similar notion of some of the largest companies that play in this leveraged finance environment?
Obviously, commercial lenders are very big players in that, so all of the big banks are involved in that. And then kind of in my world, there's all sorts of non-bank senior lenders at various different scales. On the large end, there's funds like Golub Capital, which make very big loans to support private equity acquisitions of companies, all the way down to more middle market, where a lot of the healthcare universe resides, with funds like Madison Capital, NXT, CapSource. All of those are kind of non-bank senior lenders that support the private equity community's acquisition of private companies.
Thank you. And then another question. Lately, over the last 5 to 10 years, there's been a growth in a group of investors referred to as family offices. And this is typically a family that sold a business for a lot of money, $100 million to $1 billion, and wants to invest, but wants to do it more directly. How do family offices come into play versus PE? How do you look at those things?
Family offices can come in all stripes. Some of them don't do any direct investing at all. They're just investing in mutual fund type investments, so public securities, or being the limited partner for a private equity fund, so making a commitment to the private equity fund to do acquisitions. But increasingly, larger family offices or kind of family office groups that come together, they are looking to skip some of the economics that go to the fund managers in private equity and do that investing themselves. So they're hiring kind of investment professionals, and then they're making direct investments to acquire companies, much like a private equity fund would do. However, they have some distinctions that give them a little different flexibility. For example, I mentioned that a private equity fund has a kind of a general 10-year life cycle. So they're looking to be in and out of an investment in 3 to 5 or 6 years. Whereas a family office doesn't have that 10-year horizon, and many family offices are kind of these broad holding companies that own lots of different companies and don't have any real interest, need, or desire to sell them. They're just going to continue growing them. They may hold them for a long, long time, which all that has pluses and minuses. If you are a company that's selling, because usually when a family business or a medical practice or whatever the sector is selling to private equity, they're not selling all of it. They're going to kind of roll over and be a ongoing owner, although at a minority level in that company. The dynamic of a 3 to 5 year hold period versus a perpetual hold period kind of affects how a seller is going to view that. And all of those have pluses and minuses. And it's never the case that they're going to be stuck in that company forever. But some sellers like the idea of not being on kind of the 3 to 5 year chain of multiple sales, and like the idea of growing with a partner for a much longer time. Different sellers have different preferences. So there's a lot of different choices out there, and each of them have their own kind of pluses and minuses.
And are you seeing a greater number of family offices come into maturity and be core investors or competitors for deals? Or is it still something that's talked about a great deal, but private equity is still the primary buyer of lots of different things when you go through a process?
Private equity is still the primary buyer, but more and more, especially larger family offices, are devoting a portion of their capital base to direct investing. And some of them have very kind of built out professional investor groups that are doing that. Often folks that were working in private equity funds and are now working in a family office, and others are less sophisticated in that and may do occasional deals but are not kind of built to execute on those direct investments. It takes all stripes. And there's also a growing market of what we refer to as independent sponsors, which they're also tend to be kind of former private equity folks that don't have a committed fund, whereas the private equity fund has its own kind of limited partner capital commitments, and they need to go out and find the debt to do an acquisition. An independent sponsor doesn't have the equity or the debt committed, and they'll go out and secure a target, and then they'll wheel around and say, okay, now I need to fund this with investments from capital providers, both debt and equity. And in that environment, family offices are one of the key sources of capital for the independent sponsor world. So you're kind of combining the money from a family office with the investment acumen of these independent sponsors, and that's a model that can work as well. But those are relatively new developments.
I have seen the term independent sponsors a lot the last few years, but didn't really understand it. Can you give us again, just very quickly, a 15 to 30-second tutorial on what an independent sponsor is and how that sits between sort of private equity on one hand, which has lots of outside capital, and a family office, which has its own capital?
Yeah.
Just again, give us 15, 30 seconds on an independent sponsor.
Yeah, let's say I'm the independent sponsor, and I would go out and I'd find a company that I think is a good target for acquisition. And let's say it's a $50 million enterprise value company. So I sign a letter of intent with that company that I'm going to buy it. Now I've got to come up with $50 million. I may get 15 or 20 from capital providers and the balance from debt capital providers. So I'll go out to banks or whomever to get the debt side of it, but then I'll go to family offices or maybe to private equity fund to get the equity side of that component, but of that investment. But I, the independent sponsor, kind of secured the deal, and now I have to get both the equity and the debt dollars to make that investment. I'm probably putting some of my money in, but relatively speaking, not a lot.
And how does the independent sponsor then make money in that transaction?
It can be all sorts. And some independent sponsors are acting more like brokers, and they'll get a smaller payment at the time of the transaction closing. But more often than not, the independent sponsor is looking principally for some amount of kind of fee income from a certain amount of dollars at the closing on each year. But more significantly, the independent sponsor is wanting from that investment, after all of the investors, the equity investors, have got a return of their capital, the independent sponsor might be wanting 10% of the profit. And then once you get to 2 times your investment, maybe I'll get 15% of the profit. And at three times your investment, I'll get 20% of the profit. So kind of a scaling interest in the profit of the company on a sale that scales up depending on how successful the investment is. So they're definitely wanting some form of a carried interest on that investment.
Thank you very much, and very informative. Talk to us about a different type of financing, what people think of often in smaller transactions, angel financing. Any thoughts on that and where that plays into this environment, sort of angel financing as opposed to private equity financing or an independent sponsor or family office?
What I've been describing thus far is kind of the acquisition of companies that have net income and are throwing off kind of cash flow, and purchasing those companies at a multiple of that cash flow. There's a whole other kind of arena of very exciting potential companies that doesn't have that kind of cash flow. So you think of like a technology startup, they're growing, but they're not making a lot of money yet. Or a medical device company that is about to get approval, or a drug company that is about to get approval, or any number of kind of earlier stage companies that have not matured to the point where they're throwing off a lot of kind of current income, but they have tremendous investment potential. There's a whole universe of investors that are investing kind of growth equity dollars into those companies to kind of fuel their growth to the point where they're going to be cash flow positive. And those at the very early stage, let's say I was setting up a company, a technology startup that I come up with, kind of where people go to get money first is they go to kind of friends and family and kind of scrap together some investment from people you know. The next level up is a cadre of angel investors, they're referred to. They often are people with expertise in the substantive area of what the company does, but they've made money along the way and are using some of that money to invest in new kind of up-and-coming companies. So those angel investors are usually not acquiring the company completely, but putting in money for a minority interest in the company to help fuel its growth. And then as it gets bigger, there'll be more kind of more professional investors that are still not looking to acquire a controlling interest, but they're putting in venture capital. So they're fueling the growth of the company by investing usually a minority interest in that company, but at a little bit larger scale than the angel investors, which are a little bit larger scale than the friends and family. It kind of works its way up until it's throwing off cash flow, and then it might be sold outright either to a strategic or a private equity fund.
Fantastic. So we've really talked about a number of things. You've talked about private equity funds, which is the core of this call. You've also touched on independent sponsors and family offices, all typically looking at transactions and companies that have true EBITDA, true cash flow, and so forth. Then you've also mentioned, more at the venture level, 3 different types of categories of investors that overlap as well: friends and family, angel investors, and then true venture capital investors / growth equity investors. Let me just ask you, the term angel investor, is that a euphemistic term? How does someone come up with the term angel investor? Because I think, like most investors, for an investment that's gone bad, the angel's not really that much of an angel. How do people come up with these terms?
They're not actual angels, Scott.
Thank you, Jeff. Thank you. Let me ask you this follow-up question, as long as we're on it, is you are extremely sharp. You've got this great knowledge of the PE business. You merged it with your law practice to become really one of the great leaders in the area nationally. Tell us about your personal focus and how you grew this and how you became so successful at this intersection of PE and law and healthcare and so forth, and just a little bit about your own practice and success. And I know you're shy, but so it's an embarrassing question, but just a few minutes about your own success.
I'm a general believer that everything in life is sales. When I was young, I was a carny at the fair, selling things in the merchandise area of the fair with mirrors overhead and little microphone that comes up. So I definitely believe that everything in growing businesses is selling something. One of the big benefits I've had in the practice of law is, frankly, being around you, Scott, and seeing how kind of with real dedicated commitment to kind of identifying the folks that would maybe be a purchaser of legal services, finding ways to be in contact with them on a very steady and continual basis. I remember I was a little ways along and you brought someone in that was a kind of a contact, an investment banker or something, and there were a couple of younger lawyers that were in that meeting, and the individual left, and then you were talking to me and these other younger associates. And your advice to them was to not view that single interaction as kind of its own thing, but as the start of a relationship with that individual, that you're going to do everything you can to stretch that relationship for 20 years. And all of the elements that are necessary to kind of continue relationships with folks over a long period of time. But it is continuing those relationships over a long period of time that ultimately enables you to be in a position where there's going to come a day where a prospect needs something and you'll be there. But if you didn't do the things over the 5, 10, however many years to make sure that you're still there when that moment comes, it's not going to work. And so I describe it as kind of hanging out around the rim with folks that you're trying to develop business relationships. You have to do things to make sure you're present.
Well, thank you. You've had tremendous success and have built just a magnificent practice. And more than a great practice, you've become a go-to person for all kinds of people, people that run private equity funds at the largest level to ask for counsel and advice, as well as just, you know, people that work with you, whether senior, junior, side by side, et cetera. A lot of people seek out your advice and counsel, which says a lot about the person and the professional that you are. So congratulations. I want to take a moment to thank our audience for joining us today. I know that we're also recording this for podcast purposes through Jeremy Corr of Executive Podcasting Services. And also thank you to Michelle Byers and her firm, Mantra Meetings, for their job in putting this together and handling it today. And finally, I want to thank our audience and Jeff, you for joining us. Just a terrific guest. And I learned something every time I talk to you on the clarity and the simplicity that you're able to explain things makes it invaluable. So thank you very, very much. A final question, Jeff, for you. If somebody wants to reach you, I know that on the phone are several funds as well as several people that have either different kinds of companies or practices that might be interested in talking to you. I know you'd be happy to spend a few minutes with anybody without sort of getting bills going and stuff like that. How can people reach you if they want to reach you?
One of the ways I've gone about it is to be kind of connective tissue in the market in which I live, whether that is connecting kind of investment opportunities with investors or connecting people to events or other people that can benefit them in whatever it is they're doing. I always think it's good to be connective tissue in the market where you live. So if anyone's listening either on the investor side or the company side in any sector and want to kind of chat about what private equity looks like or would like a connection to speak to someone who might be a potential investor or buyer for a company, I'm always happy to make those connections. Or if you want to bounce ideas off me, I'm always happy to do that. And the easiest way to reach me is at 312-849-8272. I'm happy to chat with you at any time.
Well, thank you, Jeff, very much. And again, thank you to Michelle, Lakin, Raiden, Michael, and Jeremy for hosting. We appreciate your help so much. Thank you very much.